The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Take Risks, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmos Mordechai Aryeh Ben Moshe Simcha Halevi, Rachel Bas Moshe Yecheskel, and Ben Sion Ben Avraham Yeshua, Aleichem HaSholem, Mr. Martin H. Rose, Mrs. Ruth Rose, and Mr. Ben Tikach of blessed memory.
Probably no word in the English language can cause as much fear and as much excitement as the word risk. How many times in life were we offered wonderful opportunities that could potentially give us much pleasure, but carried with it risk? The risk of failure, the risk of financial loss, the risk of humiliation, or sometimes even the risk of loss of life. But if we react to such opportunities, on the other hand, by completely playing it safe, we may well be doomed to an unfulfilled and frustrated life, full of regrets and stagnation. Helen Keller put it this way: avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or it is nothing. But not all risks are the same. Many are foolish and ill-conceived, while others can change your life and open new vistas for yourself and your family. The subject of this lecture is how to take risks, how to control the risks you take, and which risks are worth taking. We've divided this lecture into 9 parts, the first letter of each part spelling out the acronym, Be Careful. And that's on your handout. The B of the Be Careful is betting. One of those exciting and expensive pastimes is gambling. Whether it is a lotto where a single ticket can make you financially secure for life, or the baccarat or blackjack tables in Las Vegas, gambling has a thrill all of its own. Unfortunately, the thrill of gambling is in direct proportion to your power of imagination and the disregard you have for the odds, which are generally heavily stacked against you. I recently remarked to a friend about how infinitesimal are the odds of winning the lottery, you know, the Michigan lottery, national lottery, and how much money is poured into the lottery. And unfortunately, many of the heaviest bettors are people on welfare who can afford it the least. He replied that, on the contrary, the lottery is a tremendous bargain. Where else on earth can you buy a week's worth of dreams for just a dollar? In Las Vegas, gambling is not just a business, it's an art form. Everything that's designed for you there is designed for you to disregard reality and enter the world of make-believe. Those in the audience here who've been to Las Vegas will attest to what I'm saying. Entering a casino is like entering the Twilight Zone. Once inside, all that exists are the gaming tables. You know, they don't call it gambling, they call it gaming. You know, they don't want even to give you the sense that you may be losing something. It's all a game. And they seem to emerge spotlighted out of the darkness. The outside world has disappeared completely, since there are no windows, no clocks, and because of air conditioning, no weather. You don't even feel you're playing with real money because chips are substituted for cash. You only feel that you're playing an exciting game with no real repercussions. As one gambler put it, and I quote, this is from the book The Dangerous Edge, "I never think about money when I'm playing. If I thought I was betting my car, my house on a card, I couldn't do it. To me, it's just chips, just poker chips." As a result, the casinos in Las Vegas do a fabulous business and make tremendous profits. The same can't always be said about their customers. Another means by which the casinos trigger excitement in their customers is by creating a special holiday atmosphere. Besides the shows and the big-name entertainers that are featured in many of the casinos, as a rule, free perks are dispersed to the so-called high rollers, the regular and heavy gamblers. In order to lure these people back to the casinos time and time again, they offered free rooms, free food and drink, free chauffeured rides back and forth from the airport, and probably most important of all, personal and friendly service. The casinos have complete files of data at their computers on their regular guests, everything from their credit standing to their children's birthdays. Their dossiers also include a history of how much the players regularly bet and how much the house expects them to lose, hour by hour, day by day. Although most high rollers don't realize this, according to a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, this is May 1st, 1998, the casinos give away about $1 worth of free perks. $1 means what they would charge at full retail for every $3 that expects the high roller to lose while gambling. An expensive price to pay for the world of make-believe. On your handouts, on the second page, we discuss the Talmud's view of gambling. And gambling, according to the Talmud, has legal repercussions. Because according to a statement in the Talmud, the Mishnah of the Talmud, this is taken from Sanhedrin 24b, a gambler is considered as someone who is disqualified from giving testimony in court. And there are two reasons offered. Each reason gives us a greater insight into the mindset of the gambler. The first reason is that generally how it used to be in those days, instead of, let's say, buying chips that one does today, one would pool the money in a kitty. In fact, the term for gambling, and if you read the Hebrew, is mesachek bekuvia. The word kuvia is like cubes. It's playing with dice. It's playing with cubes. They put the money in the kitty, and of course, the one who would have the lucky 7 or 12, whatever it is the one who had the lucky turn of the dice won the kitty. But it comes out though, according to the Talmud, the people who generally put money into that kitty don't expect to lose. In fact, it comes as a rude shock to them when they do lose, and they're too embarrassed to claim their money back. And they never meant to really give that money. They meant just to put that money there to lure the others to put their money. And when they finally lose, it's a rude shock. Collecting one's gambling debts, according to this, is really a form of robbery then, because the other person really does not want to give it. That's one approach to the gambling problem. But again, we focus on not being realistic, which is really that is really the essence of the mindset of the gambler. The second part of this, and if you read the bottom here on page 2 in the first paragraph, The reason the dice that they are considered invalid to give testimony in courts is that dice players are not concerned with the general welfare. In other words, what the gambler that's disqualified from testimony is the one who is the habitual gambler, who all that he does is just gamble. He doesn't make money in a normal way. And if a person lives in a dream world and makes his money in a non-productive way, money really doesn't mean too much for the person. And therefore, in court, when you're giving testimony, and your testimony could mean the loss of money for the other party, and if you're lying or you're not careful in exactly giving over the details of your testimony, it could mean the loss for one of the parties, the gambler doesn't take it all that seriously. Because after all, it's just play money. What's money? Money is just a game. And therefore, people like that cannot be trusted to give testimony, because they don't really understand what's involved. They've never worked for a living. The loss of money is fun. Money is not hard work. It's not your life's work. And the danger that's involved for many people, many professions that we'll speak of later, the time that's involved. Money is cheap, and therefore such a person cannot be relied upon in testimony in a court. So again, the Talmud really is basing its opinion on the understanding of the gambler, that the gambler really does not live in the real world. Of course, not all financial risks are what we call gambling. By and large, the risks that a skilled investor or businessman takes are well calculated and offer much financial as well as psychological satisfaction. In fact, it can be a pastime and not just a livelihood. As Aristotle Onassis once put it, I don't know if those still remember him, the sensible thing would be for me to stop, but I can't. I have to keep aiming higher and higher just for the thrill. Which brings us to the next section. B is betting, E is excitement. The world of pleasurable risk-taking is not confined to gambling and financial risk. Some of the most exciting activities of life involve risk to life or limb, whether it be mountain climbing, skydiving, or fighting wars. Risk, danger, and fear add to the overall sense of excitement and thrill. As Chris Thorson, a Canadian troubleshooter who puts out fires in oil fields, described his work, excitement is danger's reward. The famous British mountain climber Chris Bonington wrote, and I quote, "And through it all is the undercurrent of danger. For this is what climbing is all about, staking one's life on one's judgment, playing the calculated risk." And you thought they just climbed mountains because it was there. Smoke Blanchard, an American mountain climber, described the thrill of risking one's life in the following words. "The reason I climb is because of the charge, because I get turned on. For several excellent reasons, I've never sampled psychedelics. But I know what it means to be turned on. Some things turn me on as if I'd swallowed a neon sign." Philip Caputo, a Marine lieutenant in the early years of the Vietnam War, and later a civilian war correspondent, captured the excitement and thrill of war in his compelling autobiography, A Rumor of War. And I quote, "Anyone who fought in Vietnam, if he is honest with himself, will have to admit he enjoyed the compelling attractiveness of combat. It was a peculiar enjoyment because it was mixed with commensurate pain. Under fire, a man's power of life heightened in proportion to the proximity of death, so that he felt an elation as extreme as his dread. His sense quickened, he attained an acuity of consciousness at once pleasurable and excruciating. It was something like the elevated sense of awareness induced by drugs. And it could be just as addictive, for it made whatever else life offered in the way of delights or torments seem pedestrian. End quote. Of course, to someone well prepared, many risks can be kept up to a minimum. Unfortunately, very often our imagination takes hold, and very dangerous situations become romanticized. They become a mere game rather than a very serious business. Take war, for instance. This translation of the libretto of Verdi's opera La Forza del Destino, says The Forces of Destiny, captures the romantic excitement of war with these words, quote, this is a translation, "The drum gaily beating, the bright banner flying, the bugles give greeting as guns make reply. The enemy retreating, rejoice every eye. Oh, war is exciting, yes, war is exciting. Hurrah for the thrilling glories of war." For those who love to read books on war or watch some war movie or documentary on TV or video, you can have all the vicarious excitement, fear, and danger of war in the comfort and safety of your bedroom or living room. For those who actually fight it, it isn't all that safe or necessarily that glorious. In fact, if soldiers would dwell too long on the actual horrors, death and mutilation that is a natural part of true war, it would be quite hard for commanders to get their troops to fight with much enthusiasm or to fight at all. That is why, just like in casino gambling, an artificial atmosphere is created to make war into a game of make-believe. First of all, there's the erotic terminology of waging war. Encounter, like we encounter the enemy. Thrust, penetration, withdrawal. Next to the soldiers' uniforms, especially the uniforms of pre-20th century, before khaki and camouflage, their bright and exotic costumes were the rule rather than the exception. Together with the flags, emblems, drums, trumpets, a sense of theater was created, which often masked the bitter reality of pain and death. Philip Caputo, which I quote from whom I quoted before, described this illusion of theater in his book in the following words. Quote, "As is frequently the case before an operation, we are filled with a, quote, happy warrior spirit, intent to dramatize ourselves. With our helmets cocked to one side and cigarettes hanging out of our mouths, we pose as hard-bitten veterans for the posters on the headquarters, on the Marine headquarters. We are starring on our very own war movie, and the howitzer battery nearby provides some noisy background music." End quote. Later in the book, he writes, "I'd enjoy the killing of the Viet Cong, who was run out of the tree line. Strangest of all has been that sensation of watching myself in a movie. One part of me was doing something while the other part watched from a distance, shocked by the things it saw, yet powerless to stop them from happening." End quote. This sense of illusion tends to make war a compelling and ecstatic game for many of its participants. Mark Baker, in his collection of interviews on the Vietnam War veterans, titled NAM, captured this spirit of illusion. I'm going to quote some of the interviews. I mean, it's a book of interviews of survivors of the war, of the soldiers. One interviewee stated, quote, "It was like the fantasy life of a kid. I'd played cops and robbers as a kid. So when I saw what was happening in NAM, I really wanted to cash in on it. Why not? It was like being invited to play with the big kids. They always called us men, Marines, or troopers, never boys. But during my first firefight in NAM, I was giggling." And he continues on, "You try to have fun with things. Ambush was fun. It's supposed to be professional, but it's not." One soldier interviewed by Mr. Baker said that when you killed someone, as if you, quote, scored a touchdown in front of the hometown fans. Another reported on being a door gunner in a helicopter. I quote, "I loved it. I loved flying. I liked shooting people as long as it wasn't too close. It was okay that they were shooting at me. That's part of the game." End quote. War, of course, is not just another football game. The risks are tremendous. Death, pain, mutilation. If those risks were realistically analyzed and studied, people would go to war only if their lives and the lives of their loved ones depended on them. To paraphrase the victorious Israelis that explained their victory, says after the 48 war, they did it because ein brera, they had no choice. But after listening to the way many of the veterans of war describe the incomparable pleasures of war, it seems that in order to experience these intense pleasures, you have to escape to a world of fantasy, where the danger is greatly minimized and the victims are no longer considered real people. It just becomes another game. In the handout, I quote at length, here, this is paragraph E of the handout, an incident, the English begins in the beginning at the bottom of page 2, that's the early history of Israel. The first king of Israel, some 400 years after the initial conquest of the land, was Shaul HaMelech, King Saul. After he died, Israel was divided into two. The tribe of Yehuda was led, at least for the first 7 years, by David HaMelech, by King David. For some 2 years of King David's initial reign in the south, the northern part of the country was ruled by a son of King Saul, of Shaul HaMelech. His name was Ish-Boshes. And at length, we have in translation, you could just look at it, what happens when war becomes just a game. And here the story is that the forces, they were not officially at war yet, but the forces of King David met together at a chance meeting with some of the forces of Ish-Boshes, of King Saul's son. And they said, you know what? Let's have a contest. Now let's have a wrestling match. But from that wrestling match, and you can see, just read in translation, they started taking out their swords. And a whole war ensued. There was a battle. The end was that 19 men of King David's troops were killed. 360 of King Saul's son's men were killed. It just started as a game. And very often when life is just merely a game, and it's just a means of getting thrills, at the end, says you have to pay for it. Which takes us now to the C. We start with the B. Remember, betting, excitement. Now we have C, caution. This is the flip side. We quote here from the passage in the Talmud of why the second temple was destroyed and why, subsequent to the destruction of the temple, in the following years, major other areas of Israel were destroyed by the Romans. And the Talmud attributes it to a lack of caution. And it says, happy is the man, as the bottom of page 3, that feareth always, that always keeps things in mind, what is going to happen. You know, I remember some years ago, IBM had little notepads. And in the notepad, it was think ahead was the caption. But there was not enough room on the ahead, and it had to turn like towards the side. And it was very cute about think ahead, and evidently they didn't think ahead. Many of the problems we have in life is we don't think enough. In fact, here on top of page 4, The Talmud defines who is truly a wise person. Ezehu Chochem, on top of it, Haroes HaNolad. One who discerns what is about to come to pass. In other words, the person who is wise, a person who thinks ahead. Because if you live just in a world of make-believe, a lot of terrible things can happen. But of course, this has to be balanced with the idea that you can never ensure everything. And we're going to discuss this soon in greater detail. But you can never be totally safe. You can never totally be without risk. A person opens up a business. He has to open up because he has to earn a livelihood for himself or his family. When you're buying merchandise, there's a risk. It may never be sold. And you put money into advertising, there's the risk that it may never be realized. And if you just wait for the sure thing rarely comes. King Solomon, in Kohelis and Ecclesiastes, put it this way, Shomer Ruach lo Yizra. The person who waits for the right wind to blow will never plant, because it just never comes. Beroa Ba'ovim lo Yiktor. The person who's always looking for the clouds, because he's always afraid if he starts harvesting, it may rain. And then the plant may get mildewy, you know, that which is may get ruined. It's better that it stays connected to the ground. And he waits and he waits and he waits. And he waits until the plants themselves get spoiled by not being harvested in time. You can't be too careful. And then the question is then, what is the balance? I had a friend who was a professional interviewer. What he did for a living was he interviewed famous people. You know, I guess this vicarious thrill if you can never be famous, but at least you interview the famous. So he, in one of the interviews, and he gave me a copy, I still have at home, a copy of many of his interviews. And he was interviewing Stanley Kubrick, you know, the producer, the one that says 2001 is coming soon, you know. It says 2001, you know, Space Odyssey. And he asked him, where does he get funding for his productions? You know, it reminds me of the cute cartoon that I saw. I don't know if I've shared this in a previous class. A very cute cartoon with Moses on Mount Sinai. You know, and it's Moses in cartoon form. You know, he's barefoot on the mountain. He's holding the two tablets. And you see there's the clouds and the lightning and the fire and the smoke. And he's looking up, holding the tablets, and the caption reads, "But what about funding?" So my friend asked Mr. Kubrick, he says, "How do you get your funding?" And he says, "You know, one of my greatest sources of funding is from lettuce growers. Because lettuce growers are risk takers. There's such a high possibility of a crop being ruined because there's just so many variables that the ones who go into it are invariably the risk takers." The Talmud speaks about planters in general, people that are farmers. They are people who live by faith. Because if you have no faith, some faith, you'd never do it. So ultimately, as we're going to continue on in this lecture, the C, again, the be careful is betting excitement. On the other hand, it's balanced with caution, because it's just foolish to live in this dream world. I mean, you only pay the price afterwards. And we're saying from the Jewish attitude, life isn't a game. Life is very serious. You could have a lot of pleasure in life, but life is very serious. So there has to be caution, but how do you balance that with when do you take risks? Because we all have to take risks, even if it's not going to be the risks that a mountain climber takes. It's not going to be the unnecessary risk, but we have to take risks. which now takes us to the A of be careful, which is accidents. In terms of caution, and this is a passage from the Talmud on page 4. This is a passage from the Talmud in Shabbos in 32a. And they speak about bridges. I guess the bridges of antiquity had a high percentage of danger. And a person, like, when is a person judged, so to speak? When does it make a difference if a person is worthy or not? Is when he enters those kinds of situations. And the Talmud says, don't tempt fate. And as we quote here in the bottom of this paragraph, Rabbi Yannai said, a man should never stand in a place of danger and say that a miracle would be wrought for him. Because it may not happen. And even if the miracle does happen, his merits are deducted. Words, if God is going to give you a miracle, well, he has to take it from someplace. So the benefits that you would have accrued some other way are taken away to provide this miracle for you. On the other hand, we have to be careful, but we have to ask ourselves, how careful do we have to be? Take you driving a car, for instance. It used to be, there was a precedent that as many people died in car accidents in the United States, year in and year out, was equivalent to all those that died in Vietnam. It was 55,000 a year. Now, because of better design, because of Mothers Against Vices of Drunk Driving, because of all kinds of campaigns, and because the design of cars have improved, says it's down to 42,000 a year. It's still a tremendous number. But yet we don't stop driving. So when do we and when don't we? The Talmud, and we're going to touch upon this a little later, the Talmud has a rule. What risks do we take and which don't we take? He says, those risks that normally everyone takes, we can rely that God is going to deal with us just as he deals with everyone else. And the language of the Talmud is Shomer Pesoyim Hashem. God protects the gullible, the simple. Really, you know, if they really thought about it, maybe they shouldn't take the risk. But God will take care of you anyway. There is an opinion, you know, that, well, God will take care of you, but it doesn't always come through. The difference is, you know, there's a prohibition, and this is not the subject of this lecture, but there is one of the prohibitions is to commit suicide. Just as one is not allowed to murder, take someone else's life, one is not allowed to take one's own life. We don't own our lives. We don't own somebody else's life. We're not allowed to take the other person's life. We're not allowed to take our own. When we put ourselves in a situation of unnecessary danger, and we tempt fate, and we do not win, and we are a casualty, the language of the Talmud is Domov Barosho. His blood is on his own head. He only has himself to blame, and he will be held responsible. In other words, if someone does something stupid, he shouldn't have done it. He took the risk, and he failed, and he dies. It is tantamount to committing suicide. However, if one takes risks that everybody's taking, like driving cars, if something happens, you haven't committed suicide. You're allowed to live a normal life. In other words, you do not have to be an agoraphobic. You don't have to be cluttered, because maybe you can't. I remember Howard Hughes, you know, who was afraid of the germs. He wouldn't let people into him. You know, these people constantly washing their hands. The Torah does not require you to lead an abnormal life. If these are the risks that everybody else is taking, you're allowed to take those risks as well. As long as it's in the range of normalcy, these are accepted risks. Let's say airplanes, for instance. The first test pilots, I don't know if they would have asked the Shiloh, if they would have gone to ask a rabbi, should they go into that sort of line. I don't know if the answer would have been in the affirmative. However, since flying today is considered an acceptable practice, one is allowed to take acceptable risks because you're not required to become housebound. There is a question, for instance, what about smoking? It's a real question. And the question is as follows. And really, it's a question of what answers research will give. An enormous amount of people till this day smoke. An enormous amount of people die from smoking, either from the complications through the heart or through stroke, and those as it affects the vascular system, or even a smaller percentage as it affects in terms of cancer or other things. Rahman al-Islam. But the majority of all smokers do not die from cancer. The majority of all smokers do not die a sudden death. It just so happens, if you look at the percentages of those who die from, for instance, lung cancer, you will find that the ratio of those of smokers to non-smokers may be 30-1, or something unusual. However, most smokers don't die of cancer. So could one say, therefore, well, since the majority, and this is not a sure thing, it would be considered an accepted practice if 30-40% of all Americans do such a thing. Am I allowed to do this? I'm taking what is called an accepted risk. It's a risk, but I'm not considered. And probably, if you ask a question, it would be better not to smoke. Don't expect miracles. On the other hand, it's not considered the equivalent of committing suicide. Or perhaps research will say your life will definitely be shortened because you're smoking. If a person's longevity, bar any accidents that occur, but if a person lives through his normal life and he smokes, we know he will lose 1 day, 2 days, 5 days, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years. If that would be ascertained as a sure thing, then really there would be absolutely no allowance to smoke. Because really, it's in a sense, you are killing yourself. Just to give you an example, if a building collapses on someone and it's the Sabbath, it's Shabbos, normally, this is according to Torah law, one is very careful in observing Shabbos. But when it comes to preserving a life, it's pushed aside. A life takes precedence. But what happens if a building has fallen on a person, I'll lift the rubble off the person, and the person I know will only live for 5 minutes or 15 minutes. Do I violate Shabbos then? And the answer is yes. 5 minutes of life is life. And 5 minutes of life is important, and you violate Shabbos for 5 minutes. Well, if that's the case, then one would ask, if I'm going to do something that's going to shorten my life by 5 minutes, or 5 hours, or 5 days, or months, or years, I shouldn't be doing that. I mean, that's a form of taking a life. So that really is a question which really, that a scientist has to be asked. The fact is there's a heightened risk, but it's a risk that everybody takes, does not mean it's forbidden. But if it's something which is definite, it isn't a risk. It's people are slowly committing suicide. Well, if they're slowly committing suicide, you're not allowed to commit suicide. Well, and that really is the question, that one really has to ask to find a definitive answer for. But again, it's not... there's no mitzvah to tempt fate. It's best not to smoke. But however, it says if research will show that it's only a heightened occurrence, but there are many people who live a full life, then you would be allowed to smoke. And in terms of Jewish law, really, that's where it comes out. Which now takes us to R, which is reckoning. Most of the risks that come our way are not financial and are not life-threatening. We've discussed betting, we've discussed mountain climbing, we've discussed wars, but these aren't the normal risks we are faced in day in and day out. The ones that we are faced with are the risks that you need to change your life. They're also risks. As we quoted earlier in the beginning of the lecture from Helen Keller, life is either a daring adventure or it is nothing. Nobel laureate says Elie Wiesel phrased it such: there could be no life without risk. You're in a dead end in your life. You need the courage. If you're in a dead end in your life, you need the courage to change. Life is risk. Because you have to make some decision. And the risk, generally, what are you going to lose, is not your life or your money necessarily, but the embarrassment that comes from failing. It's a humiliation of trying something and you didn't make it. And that's probably for that reason most people are stuck in their jobs and their careers. Sometimes they don't make important changes in their marriages. They don't have, we said, the courage to take that risk. It's a lot easier to spend your life like in a James Thurber's character, in a Walter Mitty, just fantasizing. About you could do this and you could do that. But you're all caught up in your imagination. You never take the risk to really do something important with your life. And again, all you're risking is that you'll fail. There's a very cute story, a fable about an eagle. Beautiful little story. It's a tremendous moral. A farmer found an eagle's egg on top of a hill. He didn't know what it was. He thought it must have been, a stray, a chicken's egg. Anyways, he took it to the coop. He had one of the hens sit on it. It hatched. It was, like the story of the ugly duckling, It hatched and it grew together with all the other chickens. And also, just like the chickens flapped their wings and just went up just a few feet, well, he also just went up a few feet, came down. The most exotic food that he had were the worms, and the grain that was thrown to him by the farmer. One day, and he's in the midst of all these chickens and roosters, he looked up into the sky and saw the most magnificent, the most dazzling creature that he ever seen. He never had a mirror to look at himself. So what is that, he asked. One of the roosters says, that's an eagle. He said, wow, I like to do that. And the rooster, forget it. He says, we're just chickens. Well, so that little eagle forgot and lived the rest of his life as a chicken. Helen Keller put it this way. I have another quote. One can never consent to creep when one feels an impulse to soar. And in order to make those decisions, it's important to realize what are the costs. What are you missing? It's like this eagle. What are you missing by not taking the chance and spreading out your wings and start flapping those wings and soaring like an eagle? We quote here on page 4 This is taken from the Talmud Moed Katan, this is 5a. In the Hebrew language, there are two letters that, as you look in the book of the Torah, look exactly the same. They're a shin and a sin. The whole difference between them is the dot. It's not printed in the Sefer Torah, but in the Chumash, you get the book, you see where the dot is. The dot on the right and the dot on the left. The dot on the left is a sin, the dot on the right is the shin. I was once attending a class, and the person was telling the audience about the teaching techniques that he used to teach the Aleph Beis, the Alpha, Hebrew Alpha, for people who have not had that, have not studied it as children. And he said one way to remember which thing is a sin and which one is a shin, because it's where do you put the dot, is she is always right. That's the shin. So the shin is the right, the sin is the left. Yeah. So again, the shin is the right, sin is the left. There is a verse that's the word there is with a sin, there's not a shin. And it is kol hasom or choisov. In other words, he who finds a focus. Som is a person who places his, makes a firm decision. This person who places his roads will see Yirav Yesh Elokim, will see the salvation of God. In the verse, really, it's a verse out of Psalms. Again, as is printed in the scroll, you can't tell if it's a shin or a sin. We just have a tradition which one it is. But the Talmud expounds that we could also read it, or at least understand it, not as Som, again the sin, but Shom, the shin. Remember, she is always right. Shin, Shom, Shom means evaluate. You have to make a cheshbon, you have to make a reckoning. Where am I going? What's the right way? And it gives it ways, in terms of it gave a little story about embarrassment. That one of the great rabbis had a student. In a private session, being a good student, he would constantly ask the rabbi questions. And some of those questions were difficult questions. The rabbi would have to pause and think. But when the rabbi would give a lecture to a large crowd, not an intimate session, the student who would be in the audience was quiet. He didn't want to ask those kinds of questions. It would put the rabbi on the spot and perhaps he would be embarrassed. So he had forethought. It isn't just the sum, the person who has the monofocused person that always the thing is just always the same, but he is the shum, the one who evaluates. And it's there's a cute little story about a great rabbi of the last generation who gave a public speech. It was really a Talmudic lecture, and evidently it seems there may have been a flaw in the logic, or at least there was room for criticism. And one of the people in the audience raised his hand and asked a very penetrating question. The rabbi on the spot didn't have an answer, but wanted to continue the flow, perhaps he would find an answer later, but he wanted to continue the flow of the lecture. And didn't want the person to continue on, like a boxer who finds a soft spot to keep on jabbing. So in the middle he said, a person who doesn't know between his left and his right has no right to ask questions here in this lecture. And that he kept on. And afterwards the person asked him, what do you mean? So he said, the Talmud says the difference between som and shom, your left where you put the dot. You didn't know where to put it. Did you put it on? You put it on the right side or the left side? On the left side means you always do the things always the same. But the shum, the one on the right side, means you always evaluate. You know, you should have figured, you know, if I'm having a hard time, it says, you wait till afterwards and privately ask me the question. But we always have to think. We always have to make a reckoning. So one of the things, what we do is we want to take risks, and again, they're very mundane risks. The risk, am I going to make something out of my life? Am I going to have the courage to spend the rest of my life in a way that I think will make me a lot happier and a lot more fulfilled? But it may have risks. It may be the risk of people laugh at me, you know, or I'll try something and I may fail, and then they'll, you know, then how could I look at people in the face? But one has to weigh. But what? Look what I could lose if I don't take that risk. So R is reckoning. Life is not just living and experiencing. We have to think, and there has to be forethought and planning. We discussed different kinds of risks, from betting and dangerous risk of war to the more mundane risks of driving a car, or even the risks of changing a career or changing one's lifestyle. I like to go through various mundane risks that are part of life. One is employment. Take a person who's a construction worker. He is taking a real risk, because working on skyscrapers or working on high, there is a certain percentage of people who unfortunately do fall and die. The passage I have from the Talmud here, this is a fray, which is a like a Talmudic commentary. This is on the book of Deuteronomy. Is about the importance of paying a worker on time, because a worker very often is risking his life for those wages. Don't take it lightly. Basically, by belittling, you know, by not paying him on time, you're belittling the very life that he's risking. But we see that one is allowed for employment. Again, this has to be regular, accepted risks. But one is allowed to take those calculated risks. So again, there are risks we take in life, and we are allowed to take, like, if only because A, they're accepted, and B, it's part of making a living. So a person is a construction worker, a person is a telephone, a person works on repairing telephone lines, or anything that's involved, a firefighter, a policeman. These are all, the community needs these people. And if a person would ask a question, should I become a fireman? Yes, you are allowed to become a fireman. But again, within the parameters of what is acceptable risk. Again, you have to make the reckoning. And there are, of course, there are accepted guidelines in any profession how to do it, except to minimize risk. So the E of this, be careful, is employment. The F is financial risk. Many times, we really take, in ancient times, a person who wanted to be an importer. An importer meant that you had to take, that goods had to travel very often across the high seas, where there was a great risk of, the boats in those days were, I won't say, they weren't like the Titanic, But they were more like the Santa Maria, the Columbus's little boats. They were very fragile vessels. There was pirating at the high seas. Not only the risk of storms, there's the risk of pirates. And yet, one is still allowed to take those risks. But the Talmud says there's a difference between risks you are allowed to take and risks we would recommend you to take. Yes, you are allowed to be a firefighter, but if it be a question of becoming a firefighter or an optometrist, for instance, you know, unless you want, you know, the thrill, you know, the charge that we discussed, you know, Probably if it's your own child, you would opt for him to be an optometrist. The same goes, even though it's not forbidden to be a firefighter. The same thing applies to what we call that kind of financial risk. And here on page 5, it's very interesting the language that the Talmud expresses itself. And it says that blessings, this is on page 5 and under F, are not bestowed upon money which comes from overseas, because a miracle does not occur every day. You can't expect there constantly be a miracle. It's an acceptable risk because people do it. And you're allowed to take, to live a normative life. But not all things that are allowed are recommended. And again, in life, it's those that take risks are really ultimately people who really, who get places. And I was, you know, it came to on Shavuos, this past Saturday night, the custom is that one stays, that there's many congregations, that one stays up the whole night studying. I gave a lecture in one of the synagogues in our neighborhood. This was about the Zionist movement. It was like from 1 to 5 in the morning. You know, with a little break. And I was thinking, you know, about the Zionist dream. And it brought to mind a quote from George Bernard Shaw. And he's saying, realistic people adapt to the world. People that are not realistic adapt the world to themselves. And if it wouldn't be for those non-realistic people, there would be no progress. Change means risk. The kunz is, the trick is to maximize the odds in your favor. Really. And that's really what the reckoning is, and the idea of the unusual risk. If you're going to take risks, they might as well be meaningful risks. You know, not just a frivolous risk. There are, which we touch upon, the U is unusual risk. There are risks that are allowed simply because you're not required to live in a straitjacket. You can live a normative life. However, again, like say the first people who flew airplanes, you know, the first of this or the first of that, the first skydivers. I don't know if skydiving is really considered really normative or not. As long as it's not considered usual, if it's unusual, you really have no, according to Jewish law, really don't tempt fate. You really, and if anything happens, it's really considered an act of suicide. You know, you may come out okay, but if you don't, you know, it's not, you have only yourself to blame. Whereas where it's accepted and you're allowed to do it, you're allowed to do it. If something happens, it happens, but you're allowed to do it and you're allowed to trust that God, you know, if you're doing what everybody else is doing, says you can, you're allowed to trust that God will help you. It doesn't always work out, but you're allowed to do it. I mean, as we quoted before, miracles don't always occur. Which takes us to the last part of this lecture, which is L of the be careful. Let's just go this, you know, just quickly before I get the L again, just to review this. The B is betting, excitement, caution, accidents, reckoning, employment, financial risk, unusual risk. And now the L is life and death. There are real, very unfortunate, very common risks that I'm asked almost weekly. Are the question of people that are in the process of dying. And perhaps something experimental or some procedure could be done to perhaps save their life or prolong their life. But it contains within the risk of death. How is one supposed to proceed? And I quote here from a passage in the Talmud. This is in Avodah Zarah 27b. There was a question about someone who was definitely, if he didn't get medical treatment, he was definitely going to die. The physician, though, was an enemy of the Jews. It would be the equivalent of a Nazi physician. There's an off chance he may save the patient. On the other hand, there's a very good chance he may kill the patient. If the physician does nothing, say the patient will live another 5 days. But the patient will definitely die. Or 5 hours, or whatever it is. But the patient will definitely die. This physician could cure him. He'll live a regular, normal life afterwards. Or the physician could kill him. And instead of living 5 hours, his life will be terminated immediately. And as we stated before, when it comes to violating Shabbos, for 5 hours or 5 minutes you violate Shabbos. So a little bit of life is important. But when it comes to the risk of a little bit of life versus living a good life, be saved, you're allowed to take that risk. And that's really the reason, you know, why a person is allowed to go. I mean, depending on the therapy and how experimental it is, and if it has any track record, or is it just, you know, grabbing at straws? And it's the question. But if there's a real chance the person could be saved, one is allowed to take that medication, even though there's a possibility of dying. I mean, these are operations. This is based on this principle. Operations are allowed. You're allowed to take the risk because what you may win is your life. And with that, I'd like to end with a fascinating story. The following story was told over by Vitaly Korachev. So he's the editor of the Russian magazine Oganyak. He's not Jewish. After describing how in two days the Nazis had executed almost 34,000 Jews at Babi Yar, you know, the ravine near Kiev, he continued, and I quote, "But it did not stop there. The Germans executed more Jews than communists, prisoners of war, anyone. By war's end, hundreds of thousands of people had been murdered at Babi Yar, their bodies heaped in piles under the dirt." He paused. "And then the Nazis became concerned for themselves. The Battle of Stalingrad did not go well for them, and elsewhere their losses were mounting. Faced with the prospect of defeat, the Nazis worried that their horrible crimes would be discovered, they'd have to account for them. So they tried to destroy the evidence of their terrible deeds. Before the war ended, the German soldiers forced the Jewish prisoners who were still alive to exhume, then burn the bodies of those who were dead. The stench of so many decomposing corpses was unbearable, and many of the prisoners were able to work only for an hour or so. Kiev, I remember, was in smog, a heavy, thick, stinking smog from the burning of the bodies. It was terrible." He paused again. "But in this nightmare, there emerged a great lesson, one I could not document until many years ago. You see, some of the victims had hoped to the end that they'd be saved." Those are the original Jewish victims who were brought there, the machine gunned. "Thought somehow they were tricked into being brought there. Others simply could not grasp what was happening, and tucked in their undergarments or elsewhere on their person were the keys to their flats. They thought they would be coming back, as if they would be able to return. The prisoners who had to burn the bodies searched for those keys and concealed them in their own clothes. Late at night, they quietly tried each key to see if any opened the lock to the barracks in which they were imprisoned. One night, one worked. Hundreds fled." Again, at this point, I'd like to stop. And then we'll go into what his lesson is. But again, the chances are, of course, that many would die. But there's a possibility that some would be saved. And again, according to the passage in the Talmud, which they consider themselves, they're only living on borrowed time, they probably would have the right to take that risk. Hundreds fled. Most, of course, were cut down by the guards' machine guns. 15 made it through, and 6 of those are still alive. This was in the 1980s, this interview was taken. 5 in the Soviet Union and 1 in Israel. Many years after their escape, this is the one who's writing, this is Vitaly Korachev, I found and interviewed the survivors for a movie I was making at the time. So this was the story. This is a fascinating story about risk. The interviewer asked him, but he said before there's a lesson. And I think the lesson is a fascinating lesson, a very eerie lesson. To me, it did affect it. He says, what's the lesson from all of this? He says, the keys to save us all, he said, are in the pockets of the dead. You know, these people, the original victims of the Nazis, were not just victims, but they had within them the power to release the future prisoners because they carried with them the keys that unlocked their lock and enabled at least some of them to survive. It's an amazing story. And he took this, in essence that, you know, the keys to our own future very often lie in the past. You know, they may have died. They're no longer with us, but they still have. They have left with us the keys to open up our own future. And it's a very, very profound lesson, which goes beyond the whole lecture. Okay, now, are there any questions?
Question is, what question about taking risks and putting your life in danger, which I wonder what the attitude of our sages would be on. It is quite common, though, in Western civilization, and it is recognized that, for instance, in the arts, many great artists push the envelope, so to speak, and some of the greatest works of art, whether in literature or painting or poetry, have been created by people who really went to the edge of sanity, and many of them as a result ended up committing suicide or going mad falling into a self-destructive lifestyle. Before that happened, they produced some sublime works of art that are really a part of our civilization and some of the greatest treasures that we have. So I don't want to mention names, but I'm sure everyone in this audience can think of some of these artists. I wonder how would our sages evaluate the situation, because on the one hand, it's not the same as a war situation, but on the other hand, there's the self-destructive element is there, but the sublime result is also there.
If someone would come to me, a gifted artist, whether it be a musician or an artist in one of the fields, and would tell him that he's very gifted, but the process of the creative process drives him mad. The world will gain from it, but he will suffer terribly. I mean, a terrible loss. And if you read the lives of many of the great creative artists, those weren't the kinds of lives that you want your children to live. And everyone's, you know, you put so much effort into raising your kids, and you want the best for your kids. That's really, leading that kind of a life is really not the one you would choose for your own children. If a Shiloh was asked, and the question was asked, should you? And probably the answer would be, if you know that you're at risk because of your psychological makeup, that and your sensitivities, that you're at risk. I would tell them, you're not allowed to do it. Your life comes first. Your life or your well-being takes precedent over what we call the furtherance of civilization, or the benefit of humanity in that sense. The only situation where we have where one is allowed to do something like that would be to risk one's life. I mean, and they're under certain parameters in order to save people from certain death. So here you are actually benefiting, you know, people. And is it giving them their life? Here you're allowed to make that risk. But otherwise, it really is not, it would not be the grounds. You're asking just in terms of Jewish law. That would be, not be the grounds, you know, for one to initially enter such a life. After the fact, the world perhaps is richer for it. But for the person himself, that really is not the path that he should have chosen. Okay, good night. We have one more question. What? Yeah, but those are basically, those are the risks, the risk of opening up, the question of getting married. It's a, people who are initially, they have to meet the right person. But you'll never know if it's the right person unless you, in a sense, open up and become vulnerable. And in the process of becoming vulnerable, you could become very hurt. But those are the risks that we have to take, you know. They're calculated risks. You know, you don't open up to everybody in the street just hoping it's going to be the right shidduch, you know. These are calculated risks, but these are definitely, one can't underestimate the fact that these are truly risks. But these are the risks you have to take.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.